This is Jeff Blankfort. My guest today, Danny Scherson, is a frequent contributor to Tom Dispatch website, and his articles have been republished in a number of magazines, including The Nation, where one of his articles we'll be discussing today, The Adults in the Room and the Problem, was published on December 27th, and one he posted yesterday on the tragedy of liberal foreign policy. What's remarkable is that Danny Scherson is an active duty U.S. Army major as well as a former history instructor at West Point, which gives him a rare insider's viewpoint that one rarely finds among the mainstream media talking heads. He served tours with reconnaissance units in Iraq and Afghanistan and has written Ghost Riders of Baghdad, Soldiers and Civilians, and The Myth of the Surge. He lived with his wife and four sons in Lawrence, Kansas. I want to welcome once again Danny Scherson to Takes on the World.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. I'm glad to be back.
I'm really glad to have you back. You are on the job. First, before discussing your insightful critiques of the adults in the room and our liberal foreign policy, can you first tell our listeners how you're able to write such articles and do so while remaining on active duty?
Very carefully is the short version. There is more academic freedom and more freedom of speech while on active duty than many listeners might suspect. But it's not a perfect system. I am retiring on February 11th, so I'm just about done with the Army, and then I'll be retired major, and I won't have to worry so much. The way I do it is I have to screen my pieces with a public affairs officer on whichever base I'm stationed at. I had to do the same thing with my book, and it has to receive clearance. Generally, you have to follow basically two or three rules in order to be able to publish the dissenting material that I do. And I have a caveat to that, which I'll get to. First of all, you can't talk about anything that's classified, okay, secretive. I never do that because I write general analysis pieces. The second thing is you can't willfully mischaracterize U.S. policy. So I can't say the policy of the United States is to nuke India tomorrow. If I were to write that, knowing that it was untrue, that would be illegal. And the final thing is I cannot be, quote, contemptuous of the president or one of my senior officers like the Secretary of Defense. That has been the area where I've gotten in the most trouble. That's been the area where I've sort of perhaps been considered to have pushed the envelope a little bit. And actually, only about 6 months ago, I was under a pretty significant investigation by the Army. The story behind that was a unnamed individual, an anonymous source, read one of my articles and felt that I had been contemptuous of the president and the Secretary of Defense. That unnamed anonymous individual called the Army Inspector General for my base at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, which set off a pretty extensive investigation. In fact, I had to stop writing for a few months until the investigation was complete. I was exonerated, essentially, and it was found that I had not specifically broken the rules. So that's the nuts and bolts of how you write in the Army. It's a very distinct process. Now, that's all the official stuff. Unofficially, writing the way I do about U.S. foreign policy, critiquing it, dissenting against the war while on active duty is not going to win you any friends within the Pentagon establishment. Okay, I am certainly not in line with most views of the President's Department of Defense or the U.S. Army, which is always my disclaimer, and I would argue that if anything, it probably hurts one's career. That's okay, since I'm moving into a full-time writing and teaching career, but it does not win you any friends, and it's certainly not the policy and position of the Defense Department itself.
Well, you have become so prolific, and everything that you write is right on point. And I had contacted you after reading your article critical of the concept of the adults in the room and who those adults actually were, which we'll get into. But yesterday, you wrote something that I've been talking about myself with friends. It's titled Hypocrisy Without Bounds, The Tragedy of Liberal Foreign Policy. And you begin by noting that if anyone else were president, the quote-unquote liberals would be celebrating. After all, pulling American soldiers out of a couple of failing endless wars seems like a win for progressives. But we have seen in just the opposite. What do you see happening and why?
Well, what's happening is two things. There's a long-term problem and there's a short-term problem. The long-term problem is liberals, progressives, whatever you want to call them, true progressives, have ceded foreign policy space to the Republicans for many, many decades now. Very rarely does a progressive candidate, does a progressive figure spend a lot of time thinking about, speaking about foreign policy. And very rarely is there a cogent, clear foreign policy from the left. That's the first long-term problem. The short-term problem, and what I think is really at work here, is Donald Trump. Donald Trump specifically, and the uncanny hatred of this president by the mainstream left. I have spent the greater part of 2 years writing critically of this man's policy. So let me not sound like a supporter per se of President Trump, although he is my commander in chief, so I have to be careful. But I've been very critical, as you know. But the mainstream left, the CNN left, the MSNBC left, and the senatorial center left, okay, in the U.S. Senate, they're obsessed with Donald Trump. He's good for ratings. When they bash him, it wins them friends and it wins them ratings and it gets them money. They are also personally obsessed with him, and anything that Donald Trump does must inherently be wrong. So what we're seeing is what I think is a prudent decision, a rare prudent decision, okay, from this administration to pull soldiers out of Syria, Afghanistan, and maybe a few other places, is being treated like heresy by progressives. And as long as they do that, they're doing two things. One, they're selling their souls, okay, because I don't think Rachel Maddow, for example, really believes deep in her heart that our mission in Syria has a reasonable end state or is a good idea, okay, is prudent policy. So one, they sell their souls, and two, this is what I really think, they're setting themselves up for failure in 2020, because if Trump's able to say, hey, the economy is decent, if it stays decent, and number two, I got the soldiers to come home, if the Democrats put up an establishment figure, say Joe Biden, who voted for the Iraq War and now argues, oh, we should have stayed in Syria, I'm telling you, given the way that the base has moved left, the way the base has moved towards the AOC, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez direction, this is a losing formula for 2020.
I know they're still trying to, there's a big push to get Biden, and he has almost as much baggage as Hillary Clinton did. It's astonishing that they would rather keep the, it seems to me that they would rather keep the hands of the power in the Democratic National Committee and lose than lose the party to people like Alexandria Cortez, Rashida Tlaib, and others who ran far to the left of the mainstream.
I 100% agree with you. I've been watching polls that, you know, early straw polls, and Joe Biden tends to be at the top of the Democratic frontrunners, which I don't know who they're asking. I don't know how well the polling is done. I find it a little hard to believe. But certainly many people within the establishment would prefer a Joe Biden-like figure. Let me say something about establishment liberals, specifically establishment liberal hawks, okay? Every baby boomer Democrat who had any presidential aspirations back in 2002, they all had one thing in common. They voted for the Iraq War. They thought not voting for the Iraq War would make them unelectable. Now, the opposite turned out to be the case. But Hillary Clinton, Chuck Schumer, Joe Biden, they even former peace protester John Kerry all voted for the Iraq War. I don't think that's a coincidence, and I think it's time to move past the types of figures who are willing to be hawkish liberals. And the problem is, in some ways, the mainstream's going even further in that direction now. Because if Trump is in favor of pulling troops out, then reflexively, the so-called progressives become reflexively in favor of these very same wars. And let me ask you this, hypothetically. Would Rachel Maddow be cheering on the war in Syria if Barack Obama had decided to pull the soldiers out? My guess is there'd be a ticker tape parade down Broadway, and there should be because it's prudent policy.
Of course, we see now that I call him President Bolton in the wings, in the shadow president. Bolton is trying to counteract that, and it seems now that the immediate withdrawal is going to be stretched out after going over and making a statement next to Benjamin Netanyahu, of course, who is opposed to the pullout. So the question is, will it happen, and is Trump really in control of U.S. foreign policy in both Afghanistan and in Syria?
You know, it's hard to know. I don't have any insider status to answer that. I can only speculate based on the open source stuff that I read. It seems, this is what it appears to me, that every time President Trump goes with his gut on foreign policy, it tends to be less involvement, a relatively rapid withdrawal of troops, especially from Syria and Afghanistan. That seems to be his gut instinct. When he's tweeting at 3 in the morning, that appears to be his gut instinct. But every time he makes such an announcement, it seems that, and we'll get to this, the so-called adults in the room pull him back to a more mainstream, bipartisan, militarist consensus foreign policy. So while I wouldn't necessarily call National Security Advisor Bolton an adult by any means, I think he's an unabashed, discredited neoconservative. But every time President Trump appears to be ready to pull the troops out, he backtracks, okay, soon afterwards. And that, to me, says that the policy process must be broken, that there is infighting within the administration, and that there are establishment figures trying to pull the president back in a further hawkish direction. One final example of this. In mid-December, President Trump, he put out an astounding, and I thought very astute, text, a Twitter remark. He tweeted that U.S. defense spending is, quote, crazy, that he was going to reduce it in 2020, and he was going to open arms control talks on Russia. Wow, I've been waiting for a president to say that for 15 years. That seems utterly sensible to me. Well, before the weekend was out, he tweeted the opposite. He said, no, actually, forget what I said. I'm actually going to increase the defense budget by $17 billion, more than the military is asking for in 2020, and there was no more talk of arms reduction talks with Russia and China. So what does this tell us? Yes, I think it's difficult to know who is really in charge of the policy process or if a substantial policy process exists within this administration.
My guest is Major Danny Scherson, and we're talking about Trump and your foreign policy and the hypocrisy of the liberals and the adults in the room who, several of them who were generals, who ordinarily, if there was an anti-war movement, which there literally has not been since just before the Iraq War, the idea that they would be supporting generals as adults in the room and trusting these generals to restrain and control President Trump, it would be astonishing if someone was told that 20 years ago.
Absolutely. I hate the phrase, the adults in the room. I hate the phrase, the grown-ups in the room. But ever since President Trump was shockingly elected, shocking the left, shocking the world, okay, ever since that happened, it seems that mainstream liberals, the MSNBC crowd, and even the centrist liberals or the centrist Democrats on Capitol Hill, they've put all their hope in the supposed what they call adults in the room, adults within the cabinet. What did they mean by that? Well, at the start of the administration, there were four figures, three of whom were generals, okay, or retired generals, which scares me in and of itself because it, I think, subverts civilian control of the military. But we'll get to that. There was Rex Tillerson, the old Exxon CEO. Somehow he became an adult. Somehow he became a prudent voice. And then there was the triumvirate of generals: National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster, an active duty lieutenant general; later Chief of Staff John Kelly, a retired four-star Marine; and of course the last adult standing, although he's gone now, Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis, who was also a four-star Marine general. So the liberals, quote unquote, they said, well, Trump is awful, but at least we can count on these adults to temper his more irresponsible or allegedly or supposedly future irresponsible decisions. I think that is bunk, because all we got from the four now fired or resigned adults in the room was more of the same. More of the same what, you ask? More of the same Bush-Obama forever war agenda. At every turn, these so-called adults in the room that the progressives or the faux progressives just couldn't wait to canonize, at every step, those four individuals pushed for more war, more bombing, more intervention, more blood and treasure in the greater Middle East. Indefinite war, indefinite interventionism, and further expansion of the U.S. military-industrial complex. That, to me, is not the reflection of adults in the room. That is childish, and it is also irresponsible on every single level. More of the same in the greater Middle East is a road to tragedy. And if we don't know that after 17 or 18 years, all of which I've spent in uniform, then we have a lot bigger problems in this country than we're even aware.
Well, this year, August, marks the 65th anniversary of Kermit Roosevelt's CIA-led overthrow of the democratically elected government of Iran, and it seems like we want to do it again. That's the one area in which, at least this far, Trump is willing to go, and he appointed Pompeo and Bolton at the urging of Sheldon Adelson, who was called for bombing Iran. Actually, Bolton's called for bombing Iran, too, before he was appointed. What do you think the prospects of war with Iran are likely in the coming year?
I am desperate to believe that there won't be a war with Iran in the coming year, but I can't say that for sure. Nobody can. It's clear that policy in the administration is rather haphazard and or at least surprises us at every turn. What we know for sure is that the current administration is populated with extreme Iranophobes. Okay, Pompeo and Bolton have both given speeches to wildly Islamist, almost cultist, anti-Iranian terrorist groups. Okay, within the United States, they've given speeches to such organizations. They've both called for bombing at one time or another. Bolton has literally written an op-ed, I believe it was either in the Times or the Post years back, that said, in order to stop Iran from getting the bomb, bomb Iran. These are the most hawkish neocons left in the administration or even in the mainstream of the Republican Party. I know for certain that war with Iran would be a disaster. Okay, this is a mountainous country, highly nationalistic, with even more people than Iraq, and we saw how bad the Iraq war went. If what we want is 30 more years of counterinsurgency, invading Iran is the perfect way to get it. The other thing I know is that there are two major powers in the greater Middle East pushing the United States to fight Iran, Saudi Arabia and Israel. Those are the tails wagging the American dog. Netanyahu and Mohammed bin Salman would like nothing better than to fight Iran to the last American life. They themselves hate the Iranians and are in the midst of a Cold War with Iran. But they would prefer that American might, American treasure, and American blood be utilized against the Iranians. So I would not rule out war with Iran. I'd like to think that this is more bluster than substance. I'd like to believe that in the end, cooler heads will prevail. But the last 17 and a half years of American foreign policy has made me increasingly suspicious and increasingly cynical.
One of the things that troubled me, and I mentioned on my programs before, is that we might be in this situation today because even before he took office, President Obama, rather than calling for an investigation of how he got into the war in Iraq, said, we have to look forward, not backward, and Nancy Pelosi seconded that, and that was effectively pardoning those who brought this criminal war that has devastated the Middle East and as far as I could see, was a catalyst for the refugee problem all over the Middle East. If we had actually had some investigations of that war, not in the same situation today. What's your response to that?
I think that it was an utterly tragic decision not to at least seek some sort of accountability from the Bush administration for what were veritable war crimes, okay, in Iraq and Afghanistan and across the Middle East. Choosing not to do so was a very centrist, a very Washington inside the Beltway move. You know, nobody is ever held accountable for crimes within the executive branch, almost never. If they are held even limitedly accountable, there's usually a pardon right afterwards. And this has been true of Nixon. This has been true of the Bush 1 Reagan White House and the Iran-Contra scandal. And it's certainly been true of the torture, rendition, illegal invasion of Iraq in the Bush-Cheney White House. I just saw the movie Vice, which was a really dark comedy. It's pretty well reviewed. Christian Bale plays Dick Cheney perfectly. And I had the exact same thought as you as I left the theater, which was, what is to stop a future administration from re-engaging in torture or re-establishing a new Guantanamo or invading illegally another country on false pretenses? What's to stop it? Well, certainly nothing legal, because there was no accountability for it in the first place. So that makes the executive branch increasingly unhinged. And this is not a Trump problem. Trump is just one in a long line of executives who have been able to stretch the power of the presidency. Okay, this goes for the Obama administration as well. Now, they may not have been as overt. They may not have been as clearly on the dark side as Dick Cheney. But it was the Obama administration, after all, that was killing thousands from the sky with drones, including an American citizen and his son, without any due process. So the decision not to hold anyone in the Bush administration accountable, I would argue, back in 2008 when that decision was taken, or early 2009, has set the stage for what has now been almost 10 more years of forever war. And I'll tell you right now, despite some of these recent, I think, fairly common sense proposals from President Trump to pull out, I would argue that if I was a betting man, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, most of these wars will still be ongoing.
Pretty depressing, and ironically, as you write, while the Beltway Congressional Military Industrial Complex continues to support ever more fighting and dying around the world, for the most part, the American people do not, and Trump's base certainly doesn't seem to show any inclination for war. Perhaps you comment on that. Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. I read a study that surprised me at the time. It took Wisconsin, which was obviously an important swing state that swung the election to Trump, and it looked at the counties with the highest rates of death, okay, in the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, the counties that have been hardest hit with their sons and daughters getting killed in the wars. Those counties voted overwhelmingly for Trump and at a higher rate than similarly demographically minded counties that did not have as many deaths in the Iraq and Afghan war. So what does that tell us? Well, it's a stretch, and there's a lot of factors here, a lot of variables. But it does seem that even members of the Trump base are a little bit tired of endless war. And Trump, we have to remember, his campaign was kind of all over the place, but one thing he was moderately consistent on was he actually was somewhat anti-interventionist. Now, he said we're going to bomb the shit out of ISIS, and he said we're going to bring back torture and worse, and we're going to throw a lot of bad dudes into Guantanamo. He threw red meat to the national security Republicans out there. But overall, he talked a lot about pulling out of Afghanistan, how Iraq was a dumb war. The Trump base is not quite as hawkish, I would argue, as the George W. Bush base. And they're many of the same people. They just, over the course of the 10 years between those two administrations, have become increasingly frustrated with forever war. So I think that the president is actually more in tune with the opinions of the average American people on foreign policy, specifically war policy, and it's rather the Washington Beltway crowd, whether it be Lindsey Graham on the right or Bob Menendez on the left, whether it be Bill O'Reilly on the right or Rachel Maddow on the left, it's those people, right, those insiders, that Beltway consensus, they're the ones, I think, who are out of touch with the American people. And pulling out of Syria, I think, is actually fairly popular with the American people, although you wouldn't know it by either watching one of the three cable news networks or following the debate on Capitol Hill.
Is there any legal basis for the United States being in Syria?
Well, we say there is. The administration says there is, and it's not just the Trump administration, it's the Obama administration. Short answer from my opinion is absolutely there is none. Technically, the legal basis that keeps American soldiers in Syria right now is the 2001 authorization for the use of military force, which I believe was signed on September 14th, 2001, while Ground Zero was still smoldering. That authorization for the use of military force, which is not quite a declaration of war, but about the closest thing we do anymore. All it said was the president is authorized to take military action against whomever he deems responsible for the 9/11 attacks. Now, you might listen to that and say, well, what does that have to do with Syria? Syria wasn't behind 9/11. True, but either was Saddam Hussein. The argument the administration, from Obama to President Trump, has made is that because ISIS grew out of al-Qaeda in Iraq, which grew out of al-Qaeda proper, that there's a direct lineage, a direct line from ISIS in Syria to 9/11. I think that's a fallacious argument. I think it's a slippery slope and really stretches the limits of our logic. The reality is that we've been told we're in Syria for a number of reasons. To fight ISIS, one, even though ISIS didn't even exist on 9/11, so I don't know how they could have been responsible for the attack on the towers. Two, to protect the Kurds from the Turks. Well, there's no legal basis for that because we didn't have any debate on that factor. And third, to balance against Iran and Russia. Again, neither of those other reasons that we were given for being in Syria was covered under the 2001 AUMF. I think that at best, the legal basis for American military action in Syria is dubious. Dubious at best, most likely illegal under international and presumably even domestic law.
Of course, we're never held to that. Other countries are, but we're not held to that. But in fact, the U.S. even, I remember Kerry talking about, we were defending, protecting the al-Nusra Front in Syria, which was acknowledged to be an offshoot, the franchise in Syria of al-Qaeda.
In many cases, our support for the rebels, which is a variety of increasingly Islamist groups, has, if anything, empowered al-Qaeda's franchise in Syria, the al-Nusra Front, which has since changed its name. I can't remember the current name they go by, but it's an al-Qaeda franchise, and in many cases, we've been tacitly on the same side. One of the things that Russia, Iran, Syria, and the United States have in common is all four of us hate ISIS. All four of us, allegedly at least, or ostensibly, hate Sunni Islamist terrorism, or really any Islamist terrorism. In some ways, we should be on the exact same side as Syria, Iran, and Russia in Syria. None of this is to say that Bashar al-Assad's not a monster. He is. He slaughtered his own people. He's dropped barrel bombs on his own people. But we have a common enemy, which is ISIS. And so by supporting groups that fought against Russia, Iran, and the Syrian regime, we were tacitly supporting al-Qaeda, which is, oh, how paradoxical, oh, how ironic, since the legal basis, ostensibly, for us to be in Syria is to fight al-Qaeda.
My guest again is Major Danny Scherson, and we're talking about American foreign policy. One interesting thing I mentioned in my last program was one of Michael Flynn's greatest crimes was that he went on Al Jazeera before he was appointed to be, before the election, in which he spoke about when he was the head of Defense Intelligence Agency, a memo in which talked about the U.S. support for Islamists in Syria, this is before there was an ISIS, to overthrow or challenge the Assad government, and that he thought this was being supported by America's allies, and he thought it was a bad idea. And that seems to have been buried by the media. But other than that, Michael Flynn doesn't seem to have committed really any other crimes.
Yeah, I mean, it appears
serious
that
crimes.
Lobbying for Turkey is what they're really attempting to get him on. I think Michael Flynn was a disastrous choice for National Security Advisor, but not necessarily for the reasons that, you know, the Mueller crowd, the Mueller investigation enthusiasts say. To me, the biggest problem with Michael Flynn all along was that he was also trying to push too hard in the direction of a regime change in Iran, and he couldn't get along with the Obama administration because of the Iran nuclear deal, which, of course, has since been overturned. So, you know, Michael Flynn's an interesting figure. He's not a guy I trust. He is a hawk among hawks and a problematic figure, to say the least. But one thing we do have to say about the intervention in Syria is that time and again, it has been completely muddled. American policy in Syria ever since the Civil War started in 2011 has been aimless. It has been, we've been on one side or the other at any number of times, and it's really been farcical. The United States is facing strategic defeat in Syria. And part of the reason for that is we had no business there in the first place. Part of the reason is we had very little strategic leverage there in the first place. But any of the purported goals of the Obama administration in Syria have, for the most part, been absolute failures.
And yet, we go back to the beginning, when Trump announced he was going to pull the troops from Syria, it created, as you mentioned, this outrage among the liberals, Rachel Maddow, I can't watch her, demanding that the troops be allowed to remain in Syria and restrain Donald Trump from pulling them back. And, you know, the irony is there was no mention or hardly any mention during the Democratic convention, the political campaign of between Hillary, who is probably the most overt hawkish candidate, certainly in my lifetime, other than like Lyndon Johnson hid his plans, but she didn't hide her plans. But even in the post-election, within the Democratic Party, there are groups called Resistance or Indivisible, Our Revolution, there's almost no discussion about our policy, our foreign policy.
No, and that's what I was saying earlier. The mainstream Democratic Party really doesn't want to talk about foreign policy. It's a very, very secondary B-side issue for the Democrats, and they've often ceded foreign policy space to the Republican administrations, I think, with the terrible results. You mentioned Rachel Maddow, and I want to say one more thing about her really quickly. This is a woman who, whatever you think of her opinions, is incredibly intelligent, right? Incredibly well-educated and articulate. She even knows a little something about foreign policy. She wrote a book, I believe, back in 2012 called Drift, The Unmooring of American Military Power. And it's a very, very scholarly and a very well-reviewed book. I actually agreed with most of the premises. She argued that American military policy over the last 30 years has become unhinged and that we are intervening in places we don't belong in the first place and that we have very little strategic foresight. I read the book and I thought, wow, she's onto something. So for that same woman to now argue that we should stay in Syria, we should stay in Afghanistan, to me shows that either she's had some sort of road to Damascus hawkish moment or that she's being intellectually dishonest and is only changing her tune because she so hates Donald Trump.
The hatred of Donald Trump I could well imagine, but it really, I've mentioned in my program, it has seemed to overturn everything. Everything was upside down since Trump became the president. It was like an inability to critically analyze what is going on outside of our borders, let alone inside our borders. And you're kind of right. If they run, if the Democrats run against Trump and not discussing what's the welfare of the American people, what the mistakes have been made, and they put someone up like Biden, who will be eaten alive, plagiarizer Joe. I could see Trump calling him. People aren't even talking about Biden's past, and yet suddenly he's a candidate. It's extraordinary. Your comments on that?
It really is. Here's what I think. Liberals, progressives, the Democratic Party, if it wants to win, and I'm not going to take a partisan stand on either side. I guess the listeners can guess where I tend to lean, but you know, another thing I can't do on active duty is speak in favor of one part or the other. But in the theoretical sense, okay, hypothetically, the liberals need to present a positivist foreign policy. Again, they can't just run against Trump. Everything Trump does is bad. They have to give us a new vision for what an effective progressive foreign policy would be. They need to make an argument that through less intervention, less use of American military power, and more prudent use when necessary of American military power, that we will both save American lives, save American treasure, and ultimately make the United States safer. If they can't make that argument, and I don't think it's that hard of an argument to make, okay, I've been making it for years now. If they don't come up with a cogent foreign policy that sounds something like that, and they just run against Trump, especially if they use a former hawk or maybe even a continued hawk like Joe Biden from the establishment, that could be extremely problematic. I would not want to run any candidate who voted for the Iraq War against Donald Trump, because he will eat that person alive, not only over that vote, but over their having been wrong for the most part on most foreign policy decisions ever since 2002.
On that note, Major Danny Scherson, I want to thank you very much for bringing an enlightening opinion to our listeners here in Mendocino County. Thanks so much again. Good luck, and we're going to speak to you again after your retirement.
Yeah, can't wait. Looking forward to it. Looking forward to retirement and speaking again. Thanks so much for having me.
This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.